This is the Bridge of the Faithful podcast, featuring your host, Jenna Erlandson.
Hey guys, and welcome to the Bridge of the Faithful podcast. I'm Jenna, and we are all traveling this faithful bridge together. These episodes are just my documentation of the things that God is showing me as I search to understand what faithfulness really means. You can find this and all other podcasts at botfpodcast.com. You can also connect with me on Facebook at facebook.com/botfpodcast. I am super excited because today we are with my friend Eric Mishney. We met in college doing theater, and I still have papers that he graded of mine for You're a Good Man, Charlie Brown, and just have some really fun memories. And now he is a professor at Cedarville, so I'm going to have him kind of talk about what he's doing now.
All right. Thanks for inviting me on. I really appreciate it. It's kind of exciting. This is my first podcast interview, and it's on a topic that I absolutely adore. Very passionate about it. So yes, I am at Cedarville University. I'm a faculty teaching in the communication department and coaching the speech team, the competitive public speaking team. Not a lot of people are familiar with that. Sometimes we call it forensics, but that confuses people and they think it's CSI. It is not CSI. It has nothing to do with science. Although sometimes we talk about science, it is not science. Competitive public speaking. And I'm the coach for the team. So I get to interact with a lot of students and help them write their speeches and that kind of thing, as well as teach basic public speaking class. And I guess you could call it an intermediate public speaking and a communication class as well.
Awesome. I can totally see that. I love that. So, going with that, how did you learn about your talent in this realm of creativity?
So when I think about creativity and my, you know, how creativity functions in my life, I don't think just about speech and being a teacher. So my mom would always tell me that I was a ham, like as a kid. Like I was very dramatic, right? I was the kid who was always putting on plays in the living room kind of thing. And so I did theater first, and I didn't do speech until I was in high school. And that's when theater, I kind of set that aside for a couple years to do speech, but then picked theater back up and did it alongside speech when I was in college. So I suppose that when I first started recognizing my talent was just by people responding to what I was doing, I guess. Mm-hmm. As I had fun and I did it because I liked it, I would get positive responses. And then, you know, so on the one hand, this is something that I enjoyed doing. But then on the other hand, I started realizing, oh, wait, people are liking what I'm doing. People are telling me I'm good at it. Let me start thinking seriously about this. And honestly, when I was in school, I had several different majors, but I was an English major at one point and I wasn't doing very well. And my advisor said to me, Eric, why aren't you a theater major? And I said, well, I don't want to just be an actor for the rest of my life. And I don't want to just entertain people for the rest of my life. Because at that point, that's what my exposure to theater had been. It had been acting. And it had been entertainment, just fun stuff. And it was that semester or so that I got involved backstage, which is, I think, maybe one of the first shows that where I interacted with you some, because I was backstage on Charlie Brown. Mm-hmm. And I also started realizing that there's some really important things that theater and the arts can communicate beyond just making people laugh. And it was at that point that I'm like, yeah, this is something that I can fully get behind for a life mission. But as you know, as far as developing it goes, you know, there's certainly the academic side of reading and studying, you know, other artists. But there's also the practice, just the do it. And being willing to do it and then suck at it for a while.
That's so hard.
or maybe not suck at it. Just do it and be willing to not be amazing and then realize, okay, here's what I need to do better. and then doing it better. One of the things that I have read in my since I kind of set theater aside for a little while and then started pursuing communication as a career, I actually read this book called Art as Experience by John Dewey. It was published like in 1917. So it's really old. It's really dense. It's kind of my artist Bible, if you will. But it's really hard to get through. But I recommend it if you're, you know, really want to understand and think about some theory of art. But one of the things that is prominent in that book is that everything is art. Everything can be art. And the creative process that you go through in everything that you do can be artistic.
When you think about seeing everything as creative, how we're going to skip around with the questions a little bit, but how does that, how do you want that to represent God through your creativity?
Obviously, I want to be as much like God as possible, right? Not trying to be God, but you know, I want to reflect God and as the ultimate creator. It's sort of, I guess it's more of just a theoretical approach that I take at that point. You know, I want to represent his creativity in what I do in so often an abstract way. I want to point people to some element of truth. I say, you know, big T truth in what I do, whether that be just through human behavior, but human behavior that's rooted in biblical truth. I certainly try to avoid anything in my creations that would contradict truth. But I don't always strive to have like a biblical message, like explicitly biblical message in the things that I do. In theater, or right now, my biggest outlet is writing. I've been writing a lot of short stories in the last 6 months or so. And I try to have each one point to something significant about my observations of the world and how God guides me, I guess, through this crazy place.
So you're kind of talking about that. Let's go back a little bit to inspiration. What gives you inspiration?
So I mentioned the John Dewey book. I will probably reference that several times through this conversation, just because it has spoken to me in so many different ways. Dewey says that art comes out of the human experience. And I think it's kind of an obvious statement, right? When you look at any piece of art, and if you were to talk to the artist, they would point you to something about their experience that that piece of art represents, you know, whether it's a painting, a sculpture, a movie, short story, poem, whatever. You know, it always is some sort of representation or symbol of the human experience, and often the experiences of the person, of the creator of it, right, of the author or the writer or whatever. And so I find inspiration in the littlest things that I do sometimes. I remember I wrote a short story once. I had met a girl and her boyfriend at a concert. It was like a house concert. And he was in a wheelchair. He was a double amputee. He was a vet. And that was the basis of a whole story. Like, the story wasn't about them. The story wasn't about either of them or even me, but I was inspired by just meeting them, thinking, okay, that's a really cool, I guess that's an interesting human experience of someone who is a double amputee war vet and who functions like everyone else. And that's something that we often, you know, I don't know, we don't think about that. There was something about that meeting him and meeting her that inspired me to write this short story. And that was it, right? So it was just one person's experience. Well, I mean, my experience meeting them that made me go off and tell that story. And I've had so many experiences like that, where a very brief interaction with someone inspires me to create something. Sometimes it's bigger, sometimes it's deeper. The first full-length play that I wrote back in, I think it was 2012 and 13, was a musical. And at that time, and honestly, still to this day, a big theme that I think about is following your dreams and not letting people tell you what your dreams are and not tell you that they're stupid and that you shouldn't follow them, that you should try to do something more stable. I'm a huge supporter of local artists and the starving artists, right? I want to make sure that they are finding value in what they do and that I support them as much as possible too. And so my first play was on that big idea, right? That wasn't a little experience that I had. And that's the where it gets difficult sometimes. I always have an idea for a story, like daily almost. There's like, oh, that would be a cool story. Oh, that would be a cool story. But then it takes more than just an idea. It takes that inspiration. I think it's a great word to use for this question, for this part of the topic is what's in the inspiration. It's not just an idea, but something else has to be there for there to be inspiration. I have to find it valuable, I think. I have to find it worth pursuing for it to be inspiration. But also the initial thought can sometimes be misleading. Mm. Like not every story that I think of, you know, in 30 seconds while I walk to my car from my house, which happens sometimes, is worth writing down, you know, and I don't know how many times I've written a short story and got done, or like my first draft of a short story and got done. And like, this is dumb. I'm delete, you know, because it's not like the idea was there, but it wasn't inspired by anything. It was one of those things like, this would be cool, but I have no idea what it's doing. So I'm going to not spend any more time on it. And that's difficult, right? Because even once I put pen to paper, I feel like I'm committed to them. And I'm a completionist. I've realized that recently. And what I mean by that is I feel like I have to complete everything. Like I have to, if I start something, I have to finish it. I can't leave any stone unturned, which is why when playing video games, like I'm playing Skyrim right now. I know this is just total side note, but I'm playing the game Skyrim and there are so many different quests you can do. I can't not do a quest if I'm offered a quest. Mm. Like I have to do everything. I have to open every little dresser. I have to open every little jar. I have to open every drawer because I feel like I'm going to miss out on something if I don't do all of the options that are presented to me. And so when I'm writing a story, I feel like if I don't finish this story, I'm not satisfied. But that's hard because not every story should be finished. And actually Dewey talks about completion a little bit too. Without incompletion, there is no fulfillment. And that intrigues me because it validates that it's okay not to finish something. But then he also says completion is where we find our satisfaction. So I don't know if he's trying to contradict himself or just trying to leave the door open to finish things and to not finish things. I don't know. It's at its core, my inspiration comes from my experiences. It comes from the little interactions I have with people and how I think I can best portray the human experience through story.
So you said, obviously, the feeling like you need to complete things is an issue, but what other barriers have you noticed?
Man, that is quite a list of things. So there's always something, there's always a barrier. And whether we're talking a mental barrier or a physical barrier, like a mental barrier to get started or a mental barrier to finish something. I mean, a lot of times my ability is a barrier or my perception of my ability because I'm like, I don't know if I have what it takes to finish this particular project or I don't know if where I'm going with this. Maybe it's an insecurity. Maybe it's a self-doubt. Maybe I just don't have the skill to do this story justice sometimes. So it goes in the back burner. I think with that particular project, the other barrier was I wasn't sure where to go with the story. So sometimes it is just my own creativity kind of runs out on that particular story. Like I got this first two scenes written and they're cool and they're dynamic and they're action-packed and they're emotional. and I don't know what else there is to do with it. And so, I mean, that's definitely a barrier when I hit this. I don't want to call it a creativity block, because I could, if I sat down and said, all right, Eric, put something down on paper, I could do it. I can force myself to do that. That does lead me to another barrier that I have, is my audience. You know, if I know who my audience will be, sometimes I'm writing for certain people subconsciously. And if I'm like, well, I'm writing this for so-and-so, but they're not going to like this, so I'm just going to stop, you know. Or as you could also call it, the expectations of the audience, or the expectations of the medium, honestly. I've done some short films, and there are certain expectations that come with a short film. You know, when you sit down to watch a 7 to 10 minute movie, you have expectations, and whether you realize it or not, they're probably there. And that can be a limitation, and that can be like, I can't meet those expectations, so I'm not going to do that. But the other thing that I try to do when I encounter a situation like that, where I realize this particular medium has too many limitations, or excuse me, not knowing your medium and not knowing how people consume that medium can be a real big barrier sometimes. And so I try to be very aware of that. Like in the speech competitions that we do, I've written some of the short stories that my students perform, and sometimes I've written them for that context. And there are expectations of the types of story that do well in competition. There's expectations of, most of the time, a first person story. So if I'm doing something for that particular context or contest, I'll always write in first person for the most part. And those are just some of the things that I have to do within the medium to overcome that particular barrier. And some buddies of mine, my friends who do short film with me, we've talked a lot about how freedom can be a barrier. Like when we've done these 48-hour film festivals, where, you know, on a Friday night we get a series of prompts, and by the end of Sunday night we have to turn in a 4 to 7 minute short film. We've created some really good stuff in 48 hours. And then there was one weekend we decided to do a film just on our own without any limitations. And it wasn't nearly as good as the ones we did when we had constraints. And so I wonder sometimes if the freedom to do whatever we want to do is limiting. I know that's ironic, but I feel like when I'm forced into a box, I'm forced to be more creative than I usually am. Like in the 48-hour film festivals, when I am given a character that I have to use, when I'm given a prop we have to incorporate, when we're given a line of dialogue and we're told what genre we have to make, those are four things that I now have to creatively work together and make them cohesive. But we try really hard to make ours natural, so that if you didn't know what the prompts were, you wouldn't even notice them. Mm-hmm. And that has really made some really great art.
So what makes you feel self-conscious, or what makes you want to quit?
I get nervous when people that I like, love, respect, and people that are important to me are going to see what I'm creating. And that makes me sometimes not want to share it with anyone. And so I suppose that definitely makes me self-conscious when someone is reading something of mine for the first time. My friends that I've done the theater and the films with, you know, I will often send them a story that I've written and ask for feedback. And I'm always terrified. I'm definitely self-conscious when I know someone is reading something that I've written and they're the first person to be reading it. Another thing I'll tell you, sometimes I will pitch an idea to someone before I write it. And I'm sure we've all had this experience where we realize how stupid something sounds as it's coming out of our mouth. it's in those moments sometimes I'm like, ah, I should have just kept that idea to myself. But I always have to remember you can't give up because you did one thing that someone didn't like. That's silly. And you can look at all of the famous artists, you know, actors, movies, or actors, you know, directors, you know, authors, they've all written stuff that nobody's heard of. You know, they've all written things that were never published because they weren't good enough to be. I can't let one bad reception of one short story idea stop me from writing any short stories. You know, and I have to reflect on the successful ones. You know, I think about the people who saw the first play that I produced, or the first musical that I wrote, and how one woman, when it was over, a family friend of ours, was talking with her after the show, and she didn't realize that I had written it. And she was saying how great it was and how she loved the story. And then someone said, I think it was my mom was standing right there, and she said, "You know, Eric wrote that, right?" And she's like, "What? Like, you wrote that?" And like, it just that shock was so validating that someone thought something that I had put on stage that I had written was good enough to have been written and published by someone else. So that was validating. And I remember moments like that. And I remember short stories that I've written that my students have performed and competed with very well. I wrote a short story or a play one time that won a national title. And that tells me I know I can write a story, right? I know how to write a story. Even though I might have some stories that are dumb, I know that I have good stories in me. And so that keeps me from actually quitting. And it kind of subdues that self-consciousness. Some, it subdues the insecurities, although I think insecurities are there for everyone. I've listened to a lot of podcasts with actors and other folks in Hollywood. And one thing they all have in common is I hear this theme repeatedly, is how they're always surprised that they get their next job. Like I've even heard, you know, famous actors, I can't remember exactly who it was right now. They were saying, but it was definitely like an A-list actor that says even to this day, he's always worried when a shoot ends, when they wrap up filming, he's always worried that he won't get another one. And I'm like, how in the world? Like, it's not quite Brad Pitt level, but something, you know, in that realm. Like, how in the world do you worry that you won't get another movie? It's encouraging to hear other people go through some of the same mental struggles that I do when it comes to my art and being creative and having success. However, whatever that looks like for you, you know, success looks different for everyone.
You write theater, you write short stories that are performed. Is it really hard to watch other people interpret your work?
It's hard to not tell other people how to perform my work.
Yeah.
That's the hardest part. You know, I'll tell you one story. The story I mentioned earlier about the prison guard, I have a student who is performing that in competition this year. And when we first started working with the piece, I was coaching him to deliver it the way I had pictured the character, right? And it was this kind of gruffer, you know, almost like a stereotypical, you know, stern prison guard. And he wasn't, it wasn't working for him. Not that he wasn't a good performer, or not that he isn't a good performer. Just that interpretation wasn't working for him. I even asked him one of my favorite coaching strategies when it comes to acting, as I say, who's an actor that you would see play this role? And in this case, he said Sam Worthington, and I'm like, okay, don't mimic Sam Worthington, but take what you think Sam Worthington would do interpretive wise, and then draw inspiration from that. He's like, okay, so he did that. And it still wasn't working. I said, so then I asked him a different question. I said, okay, fine. Let's throw everything we've done out the window, which was everything I had envisioned when I wrote the story. And I said, who is an actor that you would not see playing this character? Let's work backwards. Like, who would you not definitely not see playing this character? And he said, Josh Gad. And like, okay. Yeah, I can see that. And I said, for the sake of experiment, perform it as if you were Josh Gad. And he said, really? I'm like, just go for it. And he did. And the piece came to life. Like, and it's nothing against Sam Worthington or compared to Josh Gad. They're totally different people, have totally different kinds of roles. And I don't even know that I would cast Josh Gad in this role. But whatever inspiration my student took from him imagining Josh Gad playing that character worked. And his performance improved and his rankings at the tournaments improved. But that is nothing like what I wrote the character to be.
I'm just and picturing so, Olaf.
Yeah, right. and so that's one of the bigger challenges for me when I have students performing something that I've written is not telling them how to perform it. That is what I see in my head when I wrote the piece.
This kind of is a good segue into the last question that I really want to focus on.
Okay.
And a lot of what I've been working through with this podcast in general, it started off as faithfulness, but it's kind of turned into a mini side project of identity.
Okay.
So how, as a Christian, you know that your identity is not in your creation, but as a creator, how do you portray your identity or how do you work with your identity in the stuff that you make?
As most people are, as all people are, there's a lot of layers to me. And I think about that a lot. Like I am very much aware of the different parts of my identity. And I'm not just meaning demographically, but a part of my psyche, right? I have lots of different hobbies. If you had me in class as an instructor, you know, I'm very academic. I'm very, very philosophical. But some of my students, if I didn't have this big beard, which just imagine me having a big beard, you probably might not know that I love being outdoors and I love the nature. And I'm planning a camping trip in Alaska where I'm going to sit on a lake for 6 days doing absolutely nothing except enjoying nature, right? That's not the same type of – that's not the same identity that I have when I'm teaching in class and asking challenging philosophical questions. And then there's everything in between. You know, there's this whole art thing that I am passionate about. There's the whole – of study of scripture that I'm passionate about. There's all of these different things that make me who I am. And so when I think about how I put my identity into my writing, every piece is going to be different, I think. That's not totally true, and because there's a lot of themes in what I write. And I think it probably has to do with it comes back to experience. Like my human experience, it makes up my identity. The things I've experienced, the good and the bad, are all part of this identity too. Like I said, not just my demographics of identity, but my experience makes me. It makes me who I am. And each of those experiences work their way into my creations. And so, in a sense, since my experiences make my identity and my experiences work their way into my writing, my identity and my writing, you ready for this, are the same thing.
Ooh.
That's really high level. And I don't know, I haven't thought very closely about that actual thought before, but it's true, you know, especially because writing is part of my identity too. And being a creative is part of my identity. I definitely, I call myself an artist before I call myself anything else. And I know that sounds really pretentious and I turn my nose up at pretension, yet I'm pretty pretentious myself sometimes. But I call myself, I say I'm an artist before I will say that I'm a writer or an actor or a director. Just because, as I said earlier, you know, part of what John Dewey is really big into is our art is our experiences. Our experiences, everything around us is art. If we approach it that way.
If something horrible happened and you lost your ability to write in this way, mm-hmm. how do you anchor your identity into something, even if you lose this part of you?
What if I could never write a story again? What if I lost my hands? What if I lost my voice? What if, you know, all of those things? And there are so many different parts of my identity that I would easily latch onto. And even outside of my spiritual identity in Christ, you know, my physical identity, there are so many different parts of me that if I couldn't tell stories anymore, I would be devastated for sure, because storytelling is such an integral part of who I am. I use story daily. But I would, this is interesting. I would have to be creative in finding other ways to communicate my stories, you know, without stories. And that's really trippy to think about. Like, how do I tell stories without story?
If anyone could figure it out, you could do it.
You've got me perplexed on that one. That's a really interesting thought. That's maybe the most philosophical thing I've thought of all year.
Nice.
And glad last to year too. Or you thought of, because you asked me the question.
Kind. I guided.
Yes, yes. We collaborated on that one.
So you told me your verse is Colossians 3:23.
Yeah. That verse kind of summarizes my creative self, in a sense, because I'm so, I didn't get into this a whole lot, honestly, here, but the process is really important to me. Mm. And it's not just about the final product, which is why I talk so much about sharing ideas with people and getting feedback and the process of writing into my phone and then transcribing and then editing and all of that stuff. The process of creating is really important to me. And Colossians 3:23 says we need to do everything for God's glory. Not just the implication for me in that verse is not that I need to make things that God will like. It's that whatever you do, work at it with all your heart. Work at it. Not have a finished product with all your heart, but work at it. Do it. It implies a continual process. It implies that you are continually doing things for the Lord, not for human masters. And this comes back to a huge conundrum that Christian artists, I think, face, is that we are creating things that people are going to consume, but we're not creating it for the consumers of the people. You know, mm-hmm. it's a weird irony that Christian artists have to cope with and deal with while we create things that are physical that people are going to engage with. It's not for them. It's for God. And that includes the process. And so it's not about what something looks like in the end, although having something of quality in the end is hugely important. It's also about the process. And that's why I think this verse kind of summarizes my approach to creativity and this part of my identity.
Awesome. All right. So I have loved this conversation and I'm sad that Good. I have to cut it off. I have to, but that doesn't mean we have to end this conversation. We can still continue.
Absolutely.
But with that, we're going to thank you so much for your time. This has been really awesome.
My pleasure.
So we have Colossians 3:23. Whatever you do, work at it with all your heart, as working for the Lord, not for human masters.
This has been episode 29 of the Bridge of the Faithful podcast, entitled Created to Create with storyteller Eric Mishne. For show notes, go to botfpodcast.com/episode/29. You can find us on social media at Facebook or Instagram.